You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's news agenda with Dr. James Boyce. James, what are we looking at today?
Well, this morning we consider the fallout of the situation in Syria on Capitol Hill, look forward to today's PMQs, and consider some of the revelations that's still emerging from Edward Snowden's hard drive.
Also on the program, we'll be looking at the Philippines as a rising diplomatic and economic power in the Pacific.
And then we'll look at the terrorist version of the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
The extent to which they model corporate structures and look like familiar organizations depends a lot on the scale of violence they need to achieve. And so if they need to do either large amounts of violence, then they need a substantial amount of organization, just like any other group of human beings.
And we'll be heading to the unlikely startup capital of the Arab world, Amman, Jordan.
It all started in 2009 with the Yahoo Maktoub deal. The king wanted to do similar investments in Jordan and get regional investors and international investors into Jordan and create more job opportunities and make people invest in the ICT sector.
All that plus we check in with our woman in Athens, review the French morning newspapers, and we play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a jam-packed show as always. It's 2 minutes past the hour here in London, which means we're going to get a check of the world news headlines. Here's Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has warned America and its allies against taking one-sided military action against Syria. Mr. Putin says attacking the country without UN approval would be an act of aggression. But he said he hadn't ruled out supporting a Security Council resolution authorizing force, provided it's proved beyond doubt that the Assad regime used chemical weapons on its own people. Leaders of the US Senate Foreign Relations Committee say they've reached agreement on a draft authorization for the use of military force in Syria. It sets a 60-day limit on US military action there, with a possibility of a single 30-day extension subject to conditions. Defense Secretary John Kerry appeared before the committee on Tuesday to put the case for limited strikes.
If the United States of America doesn't hold them accountable on this with our allies and friends, it's a guarantee Assad will do it again. A guarantee. And I urge you to go to the classified briefing and learn that.
Ariel Castro, the man who kept three women imprisoned in his cellar for around 10 years, has been found dead in his prison cell in Ohio. Last month, he was jailed for life without parole, plus 1,000 years. Prison officials say the 53-year-old former bus driver was found hanging in his cell on Tuesday. Much of Venezuela has been hit by a power cut. President Nicolas Maduro has accused the opposition of sabotaging power lines, leaving 70% of the country without electricity. There was traffic chaos in the capital, Caracas, and thousands of workers were sent home. Critics say the cut was the result of poor management and a failure to invest in infrastructure. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma has appealed to gold miners who are set to strike over pay after talks between unions and companies broke down last week. Economists say South Africa can ill afford the lost output from an industry shutdown estimated at more than $35 million a day. President Zuma appealed to unions and companies in the gold industry to avoid an imminent strike that could force mine closures and cost thousands of jobs.
Both sides must be ready to give, they must be ready to take as well. Precisely because the strike, and as you know, the situation in the mining industry has not been good for quite a while. To add such powerful strikes as it looks like, I think is not going to be helpful. So we could only appeal to all of them that let them take everything into consideration and on the basis of that enrich some understanding.
One of fiction's most famous detectives is being brought back to life in a new novel by a British author due out next year. Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot, who's appeared in over 30 novels since 1920, is being revived by the best-selling crime novelist Sophie Hanna. She says her agent had suggested to publishers HarperCollins that she write a novel featuring the Belgian detective, and Agatha Christie's family gave it their blessing. It'll be set between the two world wars, but it won't feature the usual sidekicks Hastings and Inspector Japp. Sophie Hanna says including them would be too much like trying to write an Agatha Christie novel. A judge in Ohio has ordered a 58-year-old man to hold an apology sign describing himself as an idiot after threatening the Cleveland police during 911 calls. Richard Dameron has to hold the sign outside the Cleveland police station for 3 hours every day this week. He says he was intoxicated when he made the calls.
I was under the influence of alcohol, very deeply into it, and we just got to rambling off and then started acting like fools. There's a couple of us. I apologize for everything I've done, you know. I do feel bad about it, because a man's never done nothing to me.
You take full responsibility?
Full responsibility.
And there we must leave him, standing happily in the sun. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barney. You know what that just reminded me of?
No.
My moment in front of television last night, I accidentally watched the Finnish Celebrity Big Brother for a few minutes.
No.
Back to this again.
Did they all wear signs saying they were idiots?
No, not all of them. It's 16:06 in Tokyo, 11:06 in Moscow, 8:06 a.m. in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. The time is 10:07 in Istanbul. It's 9:07 in Paris and 8:07 here in London. It's time now to set the day's news agenda with the three stories you'll need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is Dr. James Boyce, Associate Professor of International Political Studies at Richmond University and a visiting Senior Research Fellow at King's College London. Welcome to the show, James. Pleasure
Good
as always.
To see you as always.
Let's begin with the political wranglings happening as we speak on Capitol Hill. Of course, yesterday we had the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing with Secretary of State John Kerry. Still get that confused.
Me too.
And Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel.
You're absolutely right. It's difficult to get away from Syria, whatever we think about. I was coming in this morning thinking about what we're going to address and trying to get something other than Syria, but it's very, very difficult because it's dominating the agenda everywhere. As everybody knows, President Obama has turned this back to Capitol Hill, and we're seeing a lot of repercussions as a result of this. We've heard overnight, for example, that the Hill leadership are going to supposedly support the president. I think there's an awful lot of undercurrents here which are worth considering, however, because it's not quite as clear-cut, I don't think, as some of the headlines are revealing. So, for example, we've heard that the Hill leadership are going to basically support the president, but what that doesn't mean is that they're going to actively help him, because what Boehner said basically is, yes, I support the president, but the president's going to have to do all the whipping himself and all the heavy lifting to get the votes through. And they're very, very different things, because in the House, for example, you know, it's the Speaker of the House who's very much in charge of getting the whipping operation and his whips to get the votes in line. He's kind of said, we're not going to be doing that. If you move over to the Senate, for example, the Senate has drafted a new resolution, which I think your piece was talking about at the top of the program there. But there's a 60-day deadline with a potential rolling 30 days, you know, which brings into mind all sorts of issues to do with the War Powers Act. So what the White House is proposing isn't necessarily going to get through carte blanche. So there's going to be an awful lot of compromise involved here. And there's absolutely no guarantee that this is going to get through in a format that the White House is going to be happy with.
Does all this have anything to do with the 2016 presidential election?
Absolutely. It has a great deal to do with the presidential election, because at the moment, the Syrian intervention has about a 9% public approval rating, 60% against. And when you look at some of the characters who are going to be forced to cast a vote on this, it's very reminiscent of what happened in about 2003, when you had presidential wannabes such as John Kerry and Hillary Clinton in the Senate having to vote upon what to do in Iraq. Now here we are some 10 years later on, people like Marco Rubio, for example, who's been making a lot of noise over the last 2 years, advocating a military response into Syria. Now, all of a sudden, he's got a vote in potentially in favor of a democratic president. He's now suddenly backtracking and saying, well, you've missed your chance. So there's a lot of people who've got their eyes on the White House in 3 years' time who are looking at this vote now and saying, well, this is going to be a potential hostage to fortune come 2016.
Well, let's talk about some of that wrangling that's happening right now in the House of Representatives. As you mentioned a little earlier, House Speaker John Boehner said he would support the president on this motion, but there is still some uncertainty over whether he's going to be corralling his members to indeed vote for this motion. But the thing is that even though he may not be doing that, if, you know, it's still quite a, you know, a statement saying publicly, I support the president. And it risks himself looking like an idiot if he can't get his very own party to support him. He looks like a weaker leader of the Republican Party in the House, which, you know, politically, it just doesn't seem to make any sense.
Well, it's interesting because Boehner, of course, had a real undulating ride in terms of his looking stupid, quite frankly. He's had a bit of a record of that. I think, however, what you're seeing is both the president and Boehner in this case trying to have it both ways by making public declarations saying we need to do the right thing, but not necessarily carrying through and doing the right thing. So Boehner here is saying, yes, I support the president. Now, I believe that if he was fully intending to try and get this through, he would then carry on and say, and I will do everything I can to get this through by supporting him by doing my job correctly. Just as with the president, he was saying a couple of days ago, I believe we should do this, but I'm going to stop short of implementing it as Commander-in-Chief and pass it over to the Congress. So I think both President and the Speaker in this case are saying one thing, but there's a subtle subtext here, which is suggesting that if they really wanted to go through and follow through, they would be actually doing so.
Interesting times, definitely there. From the US to the UK, it's time for Prime Minister's questions today. James, what are you expecting from that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's going to be a very, very interesting session today. PMQs tends to undulate. Sometimes it's less interesting than others, but quite clearly, considering the vote last week, this is the first PMQ since then. It's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. I don't think either Miliband or Cameron have emerged from this covered in laurels of glory, quite frankly. Clearly, the light will be on the Prime Minister. He was seem to have lost the key vote. But what's fascinating, I think, is there might be some degree of sympathy for Cameron for at least trying to do the right thing. But even, you know, the press are coming out saying even Ian Duncan Smith at his worst ratings wasn't as unpopular and as damned almost as Miliband has been in some quarters because of his actions over Syria this week. Interestingly enough, as you might imagine, the press in this country are split politically. The Telegraph are reporting upon Miliband's unpopularity, which is to be expected. The Guardian's got quite an interesting piece talking about the fact that a number of the key Conservative voters, members of Parliament who didn't turn up, had been recipients of Assad's hospitality in the last couple of years, and trying to draw some sort of interesting parallels there.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that Telegraph piece, which really does rip into Miliband. There's a line in the piece where it says, Mr. Miliband will allegedly, quote, own whatever disaster befalls the Middle East. There is some proof to that, though, isn't there?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, this idea that that Cameron had a gentleman's agreement effectively with Miliband, and which he backed away from at the last minute. I think what you see quite incredibly is a leader of the opposition party who's held both UK and US foreign policies to hostage. And it's difficult to try and remember an example where that's
for political
ever
gain.
Happened for political gain. And people forget often, they look at this and think, well, OK, it's high-minded politics. But ultimately, you know, this comes down to what the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, famously said years ago, which is, all politics is local. And in this case, the leader of the opposition's job is to oppose. And he's done that quite magnificently if you support him, but quite cynically if you think otherwise.
James, in the beginning of this program, we already mentioned that we're going to be talking about Ed Snowden's revelations as well. What's the latest?
Well, this is quite interesting because, of course, the Pandora's box, which is Ed Snowden's hard drive, just keeps giving and giving and giving. And to those of us who are interested in it, whether one agrees with what he's done or not, it's a fascinating and never-ending tale, effectively. The Washington Post, which I guess has partnered up with The Guardian on the other side of the pond, has got some really interesting stories which are coming out of it. The latest two deal with, this is hilarious, I think, Al-Qaeda's attempts to try and destroy the drone program. We've heard an awful lot over the last couple of years about the drone technology, which has evolved and which has gone from when Clinton initiated it through Bush and into Obama, and the fact that it's killed some 3,000 people over the last decade. Now it's been revealed that Al-Qaeda is actively targeting it and bringing in engineers to try to figure out a way around this. And this, I think, cuts very much, I think you've got a piece coming up shortly about how well organized terrorists need
need to be, which
exactly.
We're looking forward to hearing, quite frankly. And I think this fits in quite nicely with that, because it goes against the complete grain of seeing these people as almost cave dwellers, and talks very much at the heart, I think, about how organized they need to be to maintain any sense of success, and trying to stay one step ahead of the people who are chasing after them. Going after drones now, I think, speaks volumes to that. And the follow-up piece is the idea that the US is actively engaged in cyber warfare, which is no great revelation, I don't think, but the fact that they're launching 230-plus cyber operations in 2011 alone against foreign governments. We hear an awful lot about the cyber warfare that was launched against the Iranian nuclear facility, for example, the Sticknex facility. But it's clear a much a broader program underway here, and the use of technology by the US government, I think, is quite wide-ranging, and it's interesting that Snowden's revealed all this.
That was Dr. James Boyce with the stories you need to know today. Thank you very much for this, James.
Coming up in just a couple of minutes, we'll be looking at the Philippines as a powerhouse in the Pacific. Stay tuned.
Each week, Section D takes a thorough look at the design world. From fashion to furniture, from lighting to tasteful living, we'll bring you the most interesting news from design studios across the globe.
Where is society going? What is the furniture that will lead what society will want in terms of furniture functions and forms?
We see that more and more contemporary designers actually do not think about the mass-produced object. That's not what drives them. That's not what they're interested in. That's not what they think they want to contribute to this world.
It's not just making clothes, but shoes and accessories and thinking about the character or the narrative of the collection.
Join me, Tom Morris, on Section D, your one-stop guide to the world of design.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Lexus.
The Golden Leopard is the Locarno Film Festival's top prize, but it's not just the leopard print branding that sets this film festival apart. Since 1946, film lovers have been drawn to the unique mix of art and commerce at play in this Swiss mountain setting.
This is part of the spirit of Locarno, that directors talk about their craft rather than hearing a rooftop shouted mega deals. Is this emphasis on new, international art house a deliberate plan to weed out the hoi polloi and set Locarno apart? No. Locarno wants to be all about honouring cinema's rich history, discovering new talent, and doing business.
Robert Bound's report on the Locarno Film Festival is now showing in the films menu on Monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House, live from Studio One here at Midori House. The time is 15:18 in Manila, it's 11:18 in Dubai, and 8:18 here in London. Tensions in the Asia-Pacific region continue to rise as fresh disputes involving China begin to spread. The well-known cases of the Senkaku Islands between China and Japan are in the headlines often, but now the Philippines have joined the club.
Tensions between the island state and China are reaching boiling point as the Philippines accuse China of stoking tensions in the South China Sea. The Philippines has claimed that China has begun building an artificial coral reef using large concrete blocks in a disputed area off the South China Sea. The contested sea is rich in natural resources, making it a desirable stretch of water. So is this just one more regional fight to add to the list? Joining us now for more is East Asian defense expert and Monocle regular Dr. Alessia Patelano. Alessia, welcome to the program. So indeed, also here on Monocle 24, we have been talking about Senkaku Islands pretty often. Do we now need to add Scarborough Shoal on the list?
Well, I mean, Scarborough Shoal was already on the list last year because of the tension that had escalated when there was a standoff between the Filipino Navy and Chinese maritime surveillance assets. And one of the key elements here to bear in mind is that the position was China has claimed these shoals. Geographically, they are located much closer to Manila in the Philippines than they are to China, which is one of the core elements. And the Philippines have already taken China to the United Nations to have the third party ruling in terms of who can effectively claim sovereignty over these islands.
This is a complete violation of a 2002 agreement between China and the Association of Southeast Asian Nations when it comes to Scarborough Shoal here. What kind of reaction can we expect from not only obviously the Philippines, but from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. If this were to be proven the case, this would represent a violation to one of the principles of the agreement that was signed in 2002, in which all different parties, therefore China as well as the other contending states in Southeast Asia, they committed to the idea of not sort of inhabiting shoals, islands, all sorts of formations that are under dispute. Now, if you look at the situation, what we know for the moment is that there are the Philippines are telling us that there's movement of concrete pieces being moved around the Scarborough Shoal. We don't know exactly what this is going to lead to. Now, we've seen this in the past in the mid-90s when all of the southern, Philippines realized that the Chinese had basically created concrete constructions, structures that were used by the Chinese military on Mission Reef. And therefore, they're already thinking that this might be the same sort of situation. But at the moment, we actually don't know exactly what is happening. So the first thing is to ascertain what it is. If that were the case, so we're looking at another situation where a new structure was being built, then therefore, obviously, we'll have a serious violation, in which case tensions will certainly flare up.
Talking about the tensions between the Philippines and China, how does the Philippines compare to China as a military power?
Of course, this is not really a serious comparison, in the sense that there is an enormous discrepancy in terms of sheer military power between the two countries. Recently, the Philippines started acquiring or planning to acquire new assets. But at the moment, for example, I don't think they would have the capabilities to, if they wanted to actually prevent any sort of action by, say, for example, trying to mobilize their own armed forces and somewhat have a sort of a stable footprint around the Scarborough Shoal. So that, in a way, makes the balance tip towards China in this respect. But I wouldn't at the moment look at just in terms of sheer military power. I think there is a lot of political and diplomatic negotiation to be expected, precisely because the implications, as you say at the beginning, are not just about Scarborough Shoal, but it could set a precedent for the rest of the disputed and the rest of the disputes that they have in the area.
Absolutely, Alessio. A lot of concerns about a regional naval arms race as well starting to kick off. Unfortunately, Alessio, we're going to have to leave it there. Dr. Alessio Patilano, many thanks for joining us on the program. Now, there are uncountable numbers of books on managerial skills, good decision-making, and case studies on how different organizations are structured and what can be learned from them. Often, these are self-help guides for those wanting to get ahead in their careers.
Well, now there's a new book that's called The Terrorist's Dilemma, Managing Violent Covert Organizations. The book has this common approach, but a different target of research, namely terrorist organizations. Author Jacob Shapiro has applied a range of organizational theories, historical case studies, and terrorists' own internal documents even, to find out how their organizations are run and what can be learned to help the fight against terrorist action. A bit earlier, the author of the book, Jacob Shapiro, spoke with our news editor, Tom Edwards.
Jacob, thanks very much for speaking to us. I wanted to start by asking you, I guess the fundamental thing about this book is to look at how exactly the management structures work in these kind of organizations. Did you find that, for the most part, it was the same kind of management problems that confront people in much more mundane and prosaic walks of life?
Well, That's exactly the idea of the book. And what's interesting about terrorist groups is that, you know, we see this great variety in how they're organized. Some terrorist plots are carried out in a very ad hoc manner by disorganized groups of people. Some terrorist movements try and organize themselves explicitly that way by having ideological leaders giving guidance. And some look very much like they're trying to model kind of corporate forms. And, you know, trying to understand that and which kinds of groups can really produce large amounts of violence and which can't led me to the idea that they all face this problem and they all pay a cost for trying to control it. And the extent to which they model corporate structures and look like familiar organizations depends a lot on the scale of violence they need to achieve and why they think they're using violence in the first place. And so if they need to do either large amounts of violence or need to be very careful in how they use it to achieve their political goals, then they need a substantial amount of organization, just like any other group of human beings.
And Jacob, I guess therein lies one of these paradoxes, which I suppose is that the people who are, in some senses, best suited to mete out that kind of violence are perhaps the people who are going to be least inclined to follow that kind of an orthodox structure. Was that something that you found fairly frequently?
Yeah, this is something I found, and it's something that actually really struck home for me the first time. I kind of noticed it in the writings of some of the early Russian terrorist leaders. You know, folks writing in the 1880s and early part of the 20th century about how to combat the very effective Russian security state. And I brought this up in an interview I had in, I think, 2006 with Davy Irvine, who was a politician, a loyalist politician, and had been a member of the Ulster Volunteer Force. And Davy said, oh, yeah, we had that problem in spades. We had all this heinous stuff going on, and we couldn't do anything about it. We couldn't put a stop to it because we didn't have the means to control our own people. But the leadership felt like it was setting us back.
Now, Jacob, I've got to ask you, obviously, there's a lot in the book about some internal documents that from out within Al-Qaeda organization, within Iraq in particular, very paperwork heavy. I mean, how does that actually work when you're putting together that kind of analysis? Because presumably it's not like a lending library, you know, where everything's easy to access. How do you go about gaining that kind of access? And what did you find once you did?
So I've been very lucky to be part of a team that's worked through the Combating Terrorism Center at the U.S. Military Academy to pull documents from the U.S. government's database of captured documents from combating Al-Qaeda and insurgent groups in Afghanistan and Iraq. So we've been able to go in and search the full database and pull out documents that are informative about how terrorist groups are organized, and have produced a whole bunch of reports. And what we found in the process of doing that is a lot of things that looked like exactly what you or I would do if we had to manage a large number of people engaged in diverse activities, right? We'd start keeping spreadsheets. We'd start tracking our personnel. We'd want people to send in regular reports about their activities because you can't possibly keep it all in your head once it gets to any reasonable scale. This is something that's not unique to the jihadis fighting in Iraq. There's a good kind of quasi-memoir by a member of the Provisional IRA who was a leader in Belfast in the 1970s who reported that he tried to keep everything in his head because he thought that was what was going to be most secure, but after a couple of days in the job, he realized he had to have his units report what they were doing each day. Otherwise, he couldn't deconflict their activities. And so once you start to get into what these guys are writing each other, you see a lot of that. The other thing you see, which was very surprising to me, was a lot of griping and complaining. When we looked at some of the documents sent back by the folks that Al-Qaeda sent into Somalia in the mid-1990s to investigate its suitability as a base for jihad, a lot of what they were writing back was complaining about how hard it was to work in Somalia, how difficult the Horn of Africa was in general, and how much trouble they were having with local populations. They really didn't want them there. And they basically all write back asking to come back to Khartoum, where the group was based at the time.
It's kind of fascinating, isn't it, that there are these the same kind of bureaucratic problems confronted by these groups that we sometimes consider to be working on the periphery, as you'd expect from mainstream organizations. Do you think we'll ever get to the point, I mean, people are obsessed with how certain illicit organizations run. You know, people are always interested in, you know, can I learn from how the mob runs and I make my business more effective? Will we ever see that? Will we ever see mainstream businesses looking at how effective some of these organizations can be, given the management structure and the challenges that they've faced?
Well, I don't think so, in the sense that I don't think very many of these organizations have actually been particularly effective. Right. So, you know, you look at the historical record and very few terrorist organizations get anything close to their maximal goals, and only a small number make any progress at all towards the political goals that motivated the struggle in the first place.
But, and Jacob, do you think that's because of these kind of challenges that you write about, or do you think it's just because of the external pressures that they're under?
I think, Tom, the two interact in an important way, which is that you have these internal challenges, and yet all the things that you need to do to control them, to moderate those challenges, they create risks for your organization. Every piece of paper, every communication entails a risk of some government authority picking up on it and therefore killing you or taking you to jail. And so terrorists are stuck between, on the one hand, they need this bureaucracy and structure in order to get larger and to produce lots of violence and to have big effects, but each additional piece of bureaucracy makes it easier for the government to find them and combat them. And so they're inherently limited. And that's, I think, ultimately the message I want to convey in this book, is because of their internal management challenges. As long as government forces are diligent in pursuing the leads they get, these organizations can never rise to the level of a really existential threat.
That's, I guess, the main lesson. Just finally, and very briefly, what would you say, was there a particular lesson that you learned, a surprise perhaps, through all of your research and as you put the book together, maybe something that you hadn't expected to find? Was there any single thing you could pick out?
I think that the two biggest things were, the first is just how introspective so many terrorists have been about how they should organize. You know, going back to kind of the first modern terrorist groups in Russia in the 1880s, the terrorist leaders have been obsessed with this question of how can we organize for maximal effectiveness given all the problems that we face. And that to me was very surprising, that it was such a self-conscious choice in so many cases. Not always, but most of the time. I think the second thing that surprised me the most was just how many reasons there are that it's difficult for these groups to manage their personnel. And if you think about the environment these folks are operating in, the operatives see a different version of the world than their leaders do, because they have to be underground and fairly circumspect. They come from a different population. They often are motivated to join for different reasons, often much more social than the ideological reasons that drive leaders. And so for all these reasons, they're just pushed to disagree and fight amongst themselves. And just how pervasive that problem was something that really surprised me the more I got into the research.
Jacob Shapiro there, speaking to our Tom Edwards on his new study on the organization of terrorist groups, The Terrorist Dilemma, Managing Violent Covert Organizations.
In the next half hour of this program, we'll check in with our woman in Athens, we'll review the French morning papers with Daphne Denis, and we'll head to the Arab world's startup capital, Amman.
Entrepreneurs in Jordan are different from the entrepreneurs in the UK or the United States. They don't have an ecosystem that helps them in learning how to pitch to investors, how shall they do their financial projections, their marketing, and develop their product. So we had to do also training.
But before all that, we have Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has warned America and its allies against taking one-sided military action against Syria. Mr. Putin says attacking the country without UN approval would be an act of aggression. Leaders of the US Senate Foreign Relations Committee say they've reached agreement on a draft authorization for the use of military force in Syria. Ariel Castro, the man who kept three women imprisoned in his cellar for 10 years, has been found dead in his prison cell in Ohio. Last month, he was jailed for life without parole, plus 1,000 years. Much of Venezuela has been hit by a power cut. President Nicolas Maduro has accused the opposition of sabotaging power lines, leaving 70% of the country without electricity. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma has appealed to gold miners who are set to strike over pay after talks between unions and companies broke down last week. Economists say South Africa can ill afford the lost output from an industry shutdown, estimated at more than $35 million a day. One of fiction's most famous detectives is being brought back to life in a new novel by a British author due out next year. Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot, who's appeared in over 30 novels since 1920, is being revived by the best-selling crime novelist Sophie Hannah. And a judge in Ohio has ordered a 58-year-old man to hold an apology sign describing himself as an idiot after threatening Cleveland police during 911 calls. Richard Dameron has to hold the sign outside the Cleveland police station for 3 hours every day this week.
You are back with me, Dory House, on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi and Phil Hahn. It is 15:34 in Shanghai, 8:34 a.m. in London. At the heart of a region convulsed in violent conflict, a more subtle upheaval is occurring, unshaken by the type of turmoil that is engulfing its neighbours. Jordan's capital, Amman, is becoming a hub for tech startups. Internet and smartphone usage are rising quickly among the younger generations, who are also embracing e-commerce.
Compared with the Gulf, Jordan's low costs combined with a young and educated population are attracting venture capital and business brains from the region and beyond. Nigel Wilson visited Amman, the Arab world's startup city, for this week's edition of Entrepreneurs.
A quiet uprising is underway in Jordan, with women like Noor Al-Fayez at the forefront. Noor's a musician turned businesswoman, who's among the hundreds of entrepreneurs starting up ICT companies in Amman. She saw an opportunity to sell musical instruments across the region for lower prices than Western companies.
We needed something in Jordan that is targeting the local musicians. Actually, not in Jordan only, we needed something in the region because there isn't any website in Arabic for musicians. So we came up with Fisha.com. Fisha in Arabic means the connection, it's the plug. Basically, it's an online store. We provide instruments starting from guitars and Western instruments to Oriental, oud, the lute, and other dirbeke, other instruments.
Like many of the fledgling ICT startups in Amman, Fisha received a boost from Oasis 500, a program for companies at idea stage or those looking to expand. Established with the support of Jordan's King Abdullah, it's become a crucial part of the country's startup ecosystem. Oasis offers boot camps where experienced business leaders share advice with entrepreneurial wannabes.
It was easier for us to start the company within Oasis 500 because when we wanted to start at first, we had a lot of ideas that we wanted to do all at the same time. And going through their training, we learned to focus on one thing at a time. And this is why we decided, okay, we'll start with the store, then we can add all the services and all the social components we wanted to add at the first. But as we grow and as we prove our model.
After the bootcamp training, participants pitch to investors. If they impress, they not only receive a cash injection, but also office space at Company HQ and continued mentorship as they put their ideas to the market. Oasis was thought up 4 years ago after Jordanian internet services company Maktoub was bought by Yahoo. The initiative was launched in an attempt to capitalise on the high-profile success and establish Amman as a centre for entrepreneurship, as Oasis's marketing manager Omar Al-Sharif explains.
It all started in 2009 with the Yahoo Maktoub deal, and the king wanted to do see how can we do similar investments in Jordan and get regional investors and international investors into Jordan and create more job opportunities and make people invest in the ICT sector. So he gathered what we call an unofficial cabinet, or what my boss likes to call an official cabinet, and they have discussed together the gaps that are currently available in the market. One of them was that there is no seed investment for ICT startups in the market. Another thing was the acceleration process itself and mentoring, and also training. Entrepreneurs in Jordan are different from the entrepreneurs in the UK or the United States. They don't have an ecosystem that helps them in learning how to pitch to investors, how shall they do their financial projections, their marketing, and develop their product. So we had to do also training.
In a business park outside the city centre, the signs at the company's offices are promising. Even late on a Thursday afternoon, when most Jordanians have clocked off for the weekend, it's a hive of activity, with dozens of young entrepreneurs hunched over laptops or discussing their latest budgets. There are many more desperate to join.
We have around 66 companies that we have invested in, either in early stage, because we invest in idea stage startups, and also startups that have been in the market and they want to grow their companies further. We also got around 3,200 applications for companies to start companies, and we've trained around 1,200 entrepreneurs. Around 35% of our companies are led by women, so we have a bigger percentage of women entrepreneurs applying to Oasis 500 than the regular percentage in the US or in the UK.
A quick tour of the Oasis office proves Omar's last point. Women are leading the startup boom, defying expectations in a deeply patriarchal society. According to World Bank data from 2011, female participation in the labour market in Jordan is 16%, one of the lowest in the world. One of the women bucking that trend is Sarah Abu Alia, founder of Art Medium.
I think the reason why you find female entrepreneurs in Jordan is because there's a very high rate of women being educated here, and then you have also a great environment that fosters entrepreneurship. So lots of things that give you access to incubators, funding, mentors, and there's a huge community in Jordan as it's becoming a hub for startups to do this. These two elements coupled together are going to produce female entrepreneurs.
Freedom to work from home or at one of Aman's cafes means that women with other commitments can still take part. Judy Samaki, the co-founder of Fresh & More, met me at a cafe popular with Aman's entrepreneurs.
With the flexibility of, for example, my partner is a married woman with two kids. She's able to run a startup, like she can work from home, we can work through Skype, and then in the evenings she can work from a cafe away from her children. You don't have to be at one place all the time, and that plays a big role, and you don't have to be limited to time or to business hours.
Along with the ICT startup boom, Aman's nascent cafe scene is fast growing. Cafe Strada is just one of the many that have sprung up in the past couple of years, offering clean, smoke-free environments and, of course, good coffee in a bid to woo the city's entrepreneurs. American Amy Kylene Lute doesn't have an office and runs her business Hijabic from Aman's cafes full-time.
The entrepreneur culture is feeding the cafe business in Amman. When I'm at Strada, for example, there's, I don't think anyone else but entrepreneurs there, sometimes investors, and we all sort of talk to each other and work together, and it's sort of a revolving door of different people that you see and can help out and continue to get input.
Of course, the startups based in Jordan have the regional market in their sights, which is one of the most unpredictable in the world. But whilst its neighbours inch towards stability, Jordan is well placed to capitalise should the opportunity arise. For Monocle, in Amman, I'm Nigel Wilson.
That was a preview for this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs, which you can catch tonight at 1900 hours London time. That's 1400 hours if you're listening to us from New York City. Elsewhere on the show, there's an American craft beer company in Berlin, a company that's turned Mexico City's water shortage problem into a business plan, and a fragrance entrepreneur who sources ingredients from Afghanistan.
You're listening to Midori House. We take a short break now, and after that, we are back with our woman in Athens.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, a lot more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations and stunning photography, we look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shubiken dog by your side and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in all good bookshops around the world, and you can also order it at monocle.com. Happy reading!
You are listening to Midori House with Philhan and Margus Hippi. The time is 10:43 in Athens, 8:43 here in London. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world to find out what's making news in their corner.
Joining us on the line now from Athens is our contributor there, Natalie Savarikas. Natalie, welcome to the program. Shall we begin with this forthcoming international trade fair that's taking place in the town of Thessaloniki?
Absolutely. It's an annual event, and it usually gets launched with, if you like, the Prime Minister making a keynote speech where he lays out the economic policies that the country will adhere to for the forthcoming year. And of course, over the past 2 years, it's added on a lot of importance, and unions have also found it a pretty good way to start, if you like, the year in September, of course, by starting their protests. And it has gotten in the past pretty rowdy, if you like, and that's why the authorities here say they will send up to 4,000 policemen to guard the city and then prevent all these protests from spiraling out of control.
How big a media event is that then, considering that it's going to be quite rowdy? Probably is the number of journalists heading to Thessaloniki going to be big as well?
Well, traditionally, it is very big, and not only from local media coverage's perspective, because, as I said, it's also important in the economic sense, where the Prime Minister lays out his main policies. But even the international press goes there, because it's always goes for good images as well as a very important news. But last year, the Prime Minister avoided it because he had just been elected. He's only 1 year in power. He didn't want to create all this raucous when he's only been a month in power. So this year, we'll have to see. They're just trying, the government is trying to play it down a lot. The Prime Minister himself is only going to go for a few hours on Saturday. Many of the usual meetings he hosts with leading businessmen there have been cancelled. So it remains to be seen, really, what will come out of this year round.
And of course, Natalie, Greece still recovering from that horrendous economic crisis. There are some discussions of whether the country could perhaps even need a third bailout. But let's move on to another topic which highlights this increasingly tense time in the country. Illegal treasure hunting, which has become increasingly popular.
Indeed, it's pretty interesting. I mean, just last week we had thieves that were arrested in a monastery after tying up the monks and planning to dig up what they were hoping to find was a treasure within the monastery. And they even brought a mechanical digger to do that. Now, this is just the latest evidence of, as you mentioned, this massive increase in antiquity thefts and trading. And of course, this has prompted many, amidst this very gloomy times, to look for hidden treasures. Let's not forget that Greece is very wealthy in ancient heritage due to its very rich history. Police numbers are pretty startling as well. We see a 40% rise since 2009 in antiquity thefts. Only last year, the museum of Olympia, which is some 200 miles southwest of Athens, robbers raided it and looted some 77 artifacts from the ancient Olympic Games Museum. Of course, all were subsequently recovered by the police, but it just goes to show how this economic crisis has made things very difficult for the authorities, because of course they can't afford to pay the guards anymore or the archaeologists to stay on. And very often you find, especially in islands or other remote locations, only one guard to protect an entire archaeological site.
And your third story is about finances as well. It seems that there is a new victim for Greece's financial crisis.
Yes, the Walt Disney hero, Mickey Mouse, wasn't spared, it seems. This is a comics magazine that's been around Greece for 48 years. And the owner, Christos Terzopoulos, made the announcement via Facebook the other day, the social networking site, where he notified the fans that unfortunately he had to close down. And this is very much evidence of how the entire industry, the entire media industry, is closing. Many media companies are forced to close down or going bankrupt. Many journalists are found without jobs. And this is just, if you like, the saddest part of it, because many Greeks saw their whole youth in these comic magazines. So Mickey Mouse no longer in Greece.
That is a sad story. That was Natalie Savarikas in Athens. Thank you very much for this.
That is very sad indeed. Marcus, were you a fan of these Mickey Mouse comics? Did you follow Disney?
I did. I got that magazine. Actually, it was called Donald Duck in Finland.
Okay.
I got that same magazine when I was a kid, and I was just about to ask Renathity, actually. I was wondering if Scrooge McDuck was involved in Mickey Mouse magazine, because in Finland they all were, that both the ducks and Mickey Mouse were both in the same magazine.
What was your favorite character?
Oh, I think it was Scrooge.
Scrooge?
I felt attracted by the money.
I was a fan of Pluto, the dog, Mickey's dog.
Why?
Oh, it's just so cute. The little orange little dog and he had a little collar.
Do you like dogs?
I do, actually. Yeah. Okay. I would like to get one. I babysat one the other week and it didn't go very well.
You know, we're going to be looking at the French papers in a bit. I think we should play some music.
Shall
first.
We? Yeah, let's play a song. This is Golden Baby by Cour de Pire.
Et retrouver tes rires et tes sirènes. Mais quand je l'ai vu près de toi, celle qui en chanson reprend vie, je sais maintenant que tu m'avais mort.
And that was Golden Baby there by Cour de Pirate.
Daphne Dunne is joining us in the studio now, fixing your pronunciation, but supposedly you did quite well.
Phil. I tried.
It was better the second time. It was better the second time
around. Cœur de pirate.
Cœur de pirate. Yeah, that's almost there. We're almost there.
Indeed, it's time for the French newspapers, and Daphne is giving up her roundup of them. What's coming up?
We're going to talk about Syria, which is the unavoidable subject. Today, the French Parliament's debating the question of a Syrian airstrike. So we're going to chat about that, and then we're going to talk about terrible film directors and really, really scary fish.
Brilliant. Let's start with the Syria story then.
So yeah, today, basically, Parliament's going to be debating whether or not to have a strike, what the position of different politicians in France about it. They're not voting yet. They're just talking about it, which is a start. Like François Hollande said that he wasn't going to ask the parliament. Now he's sort of saying, maybe I will at some point ask the parliament.
So he's following in the footsteps of the British parliament and now the US
is.
Congress.
Yeah.
Because Hollande's really been left essentially out in the cold on this matter, hasn't he? He's been very prominent in terms of asking for military intervention, but none of his partners are really stepping up to the plate just yet.
Not quite, no. He was definitely the one who was the most eager to do this. I think Mali kind of gave him strength to sort of keep pushing and want to sort of do a limited intervention. But I think, yes, the United States and the UK sort of have killed a little bit his stamina. And now, obviously, the politicians are really divided. Libération has this incredible division between all the politicians and what they think and the different positions in French intellectual and political sphere. You will know that the one that wants to go to war is Bernard-Henri Lévy, the most awful French politician, philosopher, not politician, who just has written the most ridiculous things on the subject, as usual. He says that, you know, there's a sort of a mathematical element to it. It's like for Libya, you know, you will avoid Al-Qaeda taking power if you intervene. And he's got this whole, like, sort of very theoretical ideas about the intervention.
Daphne, you also had another story that's related to the German-French relations.
Yes, indeed. Today, Joachim Gluck, the president of Germany, is visiting France, and he's visiting one of the villages that was destroyed by the Nazis. And so France is really talking about him in a very sort of... they're just very, very thankful that he's doing this. It's the first time that this village is visited by a German official, and Le Figaro has done a little profile of him, saying that he's someone that should be sort of considered in the political sphere, despite the fact that his role is not important. It's the Chancellor who matters in Germany.
So that's kind of a milestone then in those relations. Then the third story is about culture, about a film.
Yes, that's a really interesting story. The film that won the Palme d'Or à Cannes, Blue is the Warmest Color, which is a story about lesbian lovers in high school. The director, Abdelatif Kechiche, is meant to have been awful to the actresses and to everyone, actually. But the actresses have started speaking out now in an interview with an American magazine that's been now quoted in Le Monde. He had them fight for real. When they were bleeding, they wouldn't stop. They would keep shooting. He made them do takes 100 times in a row. Once she had a snot coming out of her nose, and the other girl tried to stop her from having snot coming out of her nose, and he said, "No, no, no, kiss her, eat her snot." So he's just this crazy man that is like apparently a genius. They say he's a genius, but he's absolutely insane. And he wants people to eat snot. And
But there are lots of tales of these, you know, difficult case directors, you know, not only in French cinema, but around the world. And I'm just wondering how much of this perhaps could potentially be a PR stunt for their film, because the film Blue is the Warmest Color gets released in the United States next month in October. It seems like quite a big coincidence.
No, I think that's completely... Well, I think that's why they gave the interview, but I think that's completely unrelated, because when they went to Cannes, you know, they discovered the film. They'd never seen it before. And they're really young people. One of them, Adèle Exarchopoulos, is the first film she's ever done. And she won the Palme d'Or, and they're really happy about it. But to be honest, it seems like it was quite awful.
Definitely, there's one more story we need to cover. It's about animals, but it's not a sweet story.
No, it's not a sweet story. It's about a fish that you made me discover, Marcus.
Did I?
It's the pacu fish, a fish that's famous for eating people's testicles.
It was spotted in Denmark somewhere.
In the Seine in Paris. So if anyone wanted to take a dive, I would highly recommend not to do that. Apparently, it was someone's pet that escaped.
How did Marcus introduce you to this fish?
I follow my Nordic region, and they were spotted in Denmark, as I mentioned. But actually, this far, I haven't found an article. All the articles are about this fish that they actually eat men's genitals, but no article has mentioned what else they eat.
Went swimming in the Seine, it's not like you're really going to have an issue. You know? So I don't think you'll have a problem with that.
Thanks,
definitely.
Phil. Thanks. I'm really reassured. I would not advise you to go there yourself. It's pretty grim, to be fair. I'm quite scared of it.
That was Daphne Tunney.
Very lovely.
This morning's French morning newspapers.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today's program. Thanks to our producer, Danny Giacopelli. Our researcher was Henrietta Landaus and Gaia Lutz. And our studio manager was Chris Fitch. Up next, after the news, is The Menu with Marcus.
And Midori House will be back at the same time tomorrow. But now from me, Markus Hippi.
And me, Phil Hahn. Thanks very much for listening and have a great day.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.